As I mentioned briefly in the last lesson, this section on product and process development is a little bit longer than our typical one. It's got quite a bit of a different set of tools, and it's pretty much a refresher on systems engineering, product process control systems, plus a handful of other tools and techniques that we'll just touch on briefly. And later in the course, we'll touch on a couple of these in more detail, like process capability and some of the statistics and so on. But this is going to be just a quick overview. And if any of these areas are not familiar to you, please take a look at the reading material and or send in your questions. And let's talk about some of these so that you feel comfortable with these different tools and techniques. Now, there's a lot of elements in product and process development. And a lot of different industries use various sets of tools and techniques to make these things happen. And furthermore, we often use different kinds of language, whether we're on a military product or a medical device product. We may have completely different sets of terms for very similar things. But in general, there is a pretty standard set of ways that we go about developing programs and or developing products and processes. And we'll probably spend more, we'll spend more time on those more generic ways of approaching these things. But keep in mind that the set of tools and the techniques you use is not a one-size-fit-all. It has to be tailored to your particular circumstance. And so it's each tool that you use should add value, should actually make a difference in helping people make good decisions and to create the reliability performance you're looking for. So it's many of these tools that we'll talk about in this segment are really the domain of other parts of the organization, yet we will be interfacing and working with these teams and using these tools in part to improve the reliability, but also to improve quality and safety and functionality and all the other aspects of the product or process that we're developing. In one regard, we might consider this systems engineering, which is basically the idea of, you know, what are we going to do to get all of the various elements of this product or system working? Now, systems engineering is found more often in military systems or in very complex systems and systems of systems, for example, where there is many different disciplines and focuses that are possible. And maybe the system has many different missions or requirements that are involved in making it happen. So telecommunication systems and networks have space operations, terrestrial operations. They have high-tech computers and servers and systems like that, plus very analog-type systems that interface with it. There's also protocols and software and so on. So a systems engineering role may work between all of those different disciplines and functions in order to get them to work. In one regard, systems engineering is really looking at the boundaries between organizations, parts of your organization, to help them work better together. But it also may provide an oversight kind of role, fitting everything in from, is it the right set of functions from what the customer is expecting, and how do we support it over the long term, the logistics engineering. So systems engineer, we'll come back and talk about some more details about this in a future lesson. Another aspect of this product and process development is lifecycle costing. Now, the lifecycle, I don't think we've mentioned that yet, is that basic idea going from concept through to obsolescence. I think we did talk about that. I vaguely remember that graphic. But the idea is that the cost of ownership is one way, the way I think of it, is what the customer has to pay. So it's purchase price, installation, and servicing costs and operation costs. But there's also a way we think about it just for the development side. Now, just a quick story is some years ago when I was working at Hewlett-Packard as a reliability engineer, a procurement engineer came up and said that they had some questions for me, and they were sent to me by another person, by their boss. And he had two different data sheets. And one of them was for a field effect transistor, a FET. And it was the current system we used or bought for their particular product. And he had another one that was at half the price. And he had the two data sheets. And his argument was is that if we reduce the cost of these FET components, we would save X hundred thousands of dollars, and that would be a good thing. And he didn't know why he was talking to me, a reliability engineer. So I took a quick look at the data sheets. I saw the two failure rates. We did some quick calculations and found that for every nickel they saved, they'd be spending about $5 in warranty and field failures. And the procurement organization was very focused on the cost of the components they were buying. And they didn't really consider or know how to consider the failure rates and the cost of failure later in the system. So it was a quick example to this one engineer of how to look at the life cycle costs. What is the down the road impact of a change in failure rate, for example? Now, of course, a systems engineer would be considering spares and technicians and training for those technicians, the reverse logistics program of how do you get the broken parts back to a place where they can be repaired or disposed of properly, and in a much more complex and dynamic environment. So each of those steps, though, have cost, and the design and trade-offs that are made early in the program can have dramatic effects on the overall cost of owning and operating a piece of equipment. So it's part of the analysis process to take a look at not just the cost that's right in front of you, like that procurement engineer, but the cost over the life of the product or that particular system. Now, in product and process development, we also are concerned about what could go wrong, what could fail. Henry Petrosky often said, or in one of his books, talks about the good designers tend to design away from failure. So part of it is they have to consider what could go wrong. They want to create a product that's not going to melt, or it's not going to break under the load, or it's not going to lock up when it's not supposed to, that the functions actually operate as expected. And part of that is knowing that there's some uncertainty about the materials, the environment, how the person's using the product. And so that variability and that uncertainty helps the designers, or encourages the designers, to make the product more robust. Now, the FMEA, the Failure Modes and Effects Analysis, and we'll certainly talk in more detail about this tool, it's just one of the risk assessment tools that's available for us, but it's a great tool in product and process development as a way to prioritize what areas are of the highest risk and that we need to address. So it can be used in prioritization and making decisions and helping us early in the design process and all the way through the design process when used well. So this concept of risk analysis and risk assessment is a key piece to product and process development. Now, taking a sharp left turn and looking at a completely different concept, concurrent engineering is basically we're working in parallel. So most of the time it's between design and manufacturing. Again, another HP story is when I was working there, there were usually two engineers in a cubicle area, and they were set up as two desks with an open space between them. And later I learned that one of them was the design mechanical engineer, and the other person was the manufacturing engineer for those components, for that component that person was making. Now, these two people went to, and it was across the organization, across the design lab, that most engineers had a manufacturing engineer pretty much attached to them. And they would work together to create designs that met the performance criteria of whatever that particular component was needing to be done, needed to accomplish, but it was also with an eye towards, can we manufacture it? Can we get this and manufactured at volume and make it efficient that way? So this particular team, it's an inkjet printer, really took this concurrent engineering to heart and co-located the entire staffs so that they could consider manufacturing early and often through the design process. Now, other organizations may have different ways of implementing concurrent engineering, and it's not necessarily limited to just design and manufacturing. But some of the tools that you'll see here in the reading materials are Gantt charts and PERT charts and flow charts, the basic graphical tools that program managers use primarily to organize and coordinate the various teams and activities. So these charts typically have decision points or milestones and different key activities. One of the outcomes of these is the critical path. And so if Gantt charts and PERT charts are something you're not familiar with, it's time to hit the reading. And for those that have seen these before, just remember some of the basics and you'll be fine. Now this area, Six Sigma, it's covered more extensively in the certified quality engineer's body of knowledge. But as reliability engineers, we need to know about this also. It is the design for Six Sigma or Six Sigma Lean, I think it's also called Lean Six Sigma, and there's a handful of other variations of this, is a pretty basic tool, but using the concept that whenever we're manufacturing something, it's going to have some variability. So the basic idea here is if I'm designing a product and I need to create a widget that has a certain amount of strength, I know that the specification for the strength, or say, let's use length. Let's say the length has to be within that set of tolerances in my length. And if I create a product that has the manufactured variability that is very small compared to my specification, then even if this value shifts, and the folks at Motorola that really came up, in my opinion, with the Six Sigma approach, said that the manufacturing process over time is likely to shift in one direction or the other by as much as 1.5 standard deviations. So if those standard deviations are small, even a 1.5 standard deviation shift will keep the product within the specifications, will keep that particular device within the length requirements. But if the, on the other hand, if the manufactured variation is rather large, a 1.5 sigma shift will create products that are outside the specifications. So Six Sigma, in a very simplistic sense, is creating a balance between what you're capable of manufacturing and the variation that you see there from a stable process. So we'll talk way more about process control and process capability later. And our specifications, we can accommodate the variation in the manufacturing process without creating products and devices or components that are out of specification. By doing so, we also then tend to focus on increasing our specifications and requirements so that the manufacturing process can be accommodate its natural way of being manufactured without undue yield or inspection or concern about its variability. On the other hand, it also helps us understand which of the components are critical that we do need to monitor and track very closely. It's the ones with the least margin. Again, we'll talk some more about these similar concepts when we talk about process capability. Another tool, and this one's I think many of us do this pretty naturally. And so one way it's termed is DMAIC, DMAIC, I think is the way it's pronounced, is basically a problem-solving process. Is we define the problem, and many argue that that's the key element of solving a problem, is having a good definition of it. What is it, and how do you measure it, and how would you know if it's changed or not? And then go measure, make some measurements, go gather data, and then do the analysis, find out what you have. Now, this measurement step might be as simple as going down to the factory floor and making some readings. Or it may be as sophisticated as a very elaborate design of experiments. Then we do the analysis and take a look at what the data says and what's the numbers say, and it's a bit where the statistics come in. And we look for those opportunities to either lock in the improvements or to look for improvements that we could put in place. And then as needed, then we put in controls to make sure that those improvements remain in place, or the minimization of the adverse effects. So it may be the opposite of improve, it'd be avoiding bad things. And again, putting controls in place to make that sustain over the long term. Now, you may also know this as the plan, do, check, act process, which again is very, very similar. And there's a handful of other variations to it. Another group of techniques is lean, and there's quite a few different tools within this, and there's many, many books associated with this. For our purposes, it usually means that we're getting rid of waste within a process, unnecessary steps, anything that wastes time or increases lead times, creates more scrap or loss. Also is efficient use of all of our resources and tools and equipment and so on. So it runs the gamut from everything from component supply chain management, so that just the right number of components appear for today's production. We call that just in time. But it also goes to devices and tools that we use to make sure that, say, an assembly is error-proofed, is one term it's used. A Poka-Yoka is a gauge that may not even have any numbers on it, but it's a way of checking, say, a clearance. Either it's fit correctly or it's not fit correctly, or it's the right component or it's not, and gives you a go-no-go kind of gauge for your process. SOPs, being standard operating procedures, is a key part of lean techniques, where we do have a process that's well thought out and very efficient, but it's also, that's the process. That's the way we do things. And there's some discipline that comes with staying with the process, not making tweaks and adjustments as you go, unless it's well thought out and the team agrees that it's going to make an improvement to your process. So lean is commonly associated with manufacturing processes, but it also has roles in the manufacture, in the design processes, and marketing, and shipping, and so on. It can get involved in many different parts of your organization. One of the aspects of lean is another set of tools or a concept that came out of Japan, hence the Japanese words. But they're rough translations, trying to go with the S starting letter, is basically housekeeping. And I was in an visiting a factory that made circuit boards some years ago. And just before the end of the shift, about 20, 30 minutes before the end of the shift, they stopped production and they broke out brooms and rags and cleaning equipment. And they went through and organized and sorted and cleaned and put everything back in place. And one of the benefits was the equipment that I was working with was the cleanest I'd ever seen, other than brand new equipment. But it made it very easy for the team and the technicians to spot any problems. So if a line was leaking oil, it may have operated just fine, but it would eventually get worse. And so spotting that leak early allowed them to plan on fixing it when it didn't disrupt the production flow, is one example. But it also did things that are right back to the lean concept. They had different sets of tools they needed as they operated this equipment, and they had shadow boards where the tools were laid in exactly the right place and generally in the right order as they would need them. And so at the end of each shift, they made sure all the tools were back in place. But even during the day, that's where they kept their tools because it made their jobs more efficient. And it was a lot easier just grabbing the tool that you know is always going to be there rather than digging through a box or trying to hunt down the right tool. Another whole set of tools is called Kaizen and Kaizen Blitz. And it's a process improvement focus, and the Blitz just means that you're doing a concentrated effort over a shorter period of time. But the idea is that if you've got processes and you've got techniques and tools and procedures that you regularly use, there's generally room for improvement. So the plan, do, check, act improvement cycles, or the DMAC type improvement processes, suggestion boxes from all elements of your organization, is you're looking for those areas that allows you to improve the quality, improve the yield, improve the throughput, improve the efficiency, reduce waste, reduce scrap, all of those kinds of things. So it's, again, generally associated with manufacturing processes, but it can have an impact in many other parts of the organization. Now, there's lots of other lean terms and techniques and approaches, and this is just a short list of these. And in the reading, there's more material about each one of these. But the basic idea is that we're trying to create efficient, streamlined, very clear, and very low chance of failures processes. We want to reduce scrap and increase throughput and find the right balance to do that. Now, we also need to create processes that adapt to the different programs and products that we're bringing to it and the different demands that are placed on the system. And so it's a never-ending process of working to make sure that your process is as efficient as you can make it, such that you create the reliability and the quality in your products that you desire. So basically, I'm going to go back to this concept of life cycle. And the basic idea of the process of creating a product in over its entire lifetime. So to what extent is reliability a part of your life cycle? And can you identify all of the places that reliability is touching your system or should be touching your system? In the next segment, we'll talk about what happens when something fails and what are those consequences.